What are the three things that I can do and I will be successful according to you?
I think it's more important to be happy than to be successful.
Yeah. But maybe your success is happy. Welcome to Pass the Power with me, Paige Parker. I'm an author, advocate, tiger mom, and even claim a Guinness World Record for traveling the world to 116 countries with my husband, Jim Rogers. We up and left New York City 15 years ago to move to Singapore. Why? Because we believe Asia's the future and we wanted to immerse our daughters in Asia as well as for them to be fluent in Mandarin. Tamin Shaw, Hin Hao, Mama Shaw, Buhao. This podcast began during the pandemic because I wanted to offer conversations of hope. And as it evolves, I hope I do too. I'll dig deeper personally and give you more from guests as I continue to tap into my connections, sharing the most compelling stories to help you attain your goals personally and professionally. As a lifelong learner myself, there's little more I enjoy than exploring topics with our fascinating guests and sharing it all with you. So together, we may pass the power. I first met Alfian Saad a decade ago during a backstage tour with Wild Rice. I'd heard so many words to describe him: dissident, grumpy, and troublemaker. But I found him polite and engaging, and I wondered how he could be so bad. In truth, he's not. Alfian just speaks his mind, which often doesn't agree with the party line. As a result, he's a bit of an outlier. I think you'll love our chat. Welcome, Alfian. Thank you for being here. As I was saying before, I think you're the first non-PAP person that I've had on. I've had ministers and I've had government folks. Right. And, you know, you're the first contrarian I've had on.
I feel like I put in a bit of a spot, but yeah, let's see where this goes.
Why don't you introduce yourself in case somebody's living under a rock and doesn't know who you are?
Okay, sure. So my name is Alfian Saad. I am the resident playwright with Wild Rice. So I've been with the company since the year 2004. So what I do with the company is that I write plays for their season and I help the programming as well.
I guess the elephant in the room is when I say you're the contrarian. Many people see that you speak out for those who have less of a voice than those in the majority. Mm-hmm. And I know that you're Malay, Muslim.
Yep.
You went to RI and RJC, where I imagine most of the people at the school didn't look like you and were different from you. Mm-hmm. Was that a part of the journey for you to rally for those not a part of the privileged?
No, absolutely. So I come from a pretty working class background. So my father was a policeman, a customs policeman, the Port Singapore Authority. My mother was a factory worker. So definitely when I went to those elite schools, there was a sense of a betrayal of my own class origins. I suppose a kind of estrangement as well from the lives of my parents. That was something that I had to negotiate in terms of my identity growing up. So I would speak Malay at home with them, for example, and then in school, my peers, I would predominantly speak in English. And gradually over time, English overtook Malay as my main language.
But you were the top Malay scorer.
Yes, I think when I was taking my PSLE, as well as I think my O-levels as well.
You did well in school. Were your parents proud of you?
Of course, they were very proud of me, right? So I think in terms of Singapore story, you have all this, the story of social mobility, the story of the next generation kind of like doing better than the previous one. Yeah, but I think over the years also I've become quite sensitized to the idea that going out of your class bracket can be kind of profoundly alienating also when you realize that, oh, actually the lives of your parents in terms of the things and the skills and the life experiences that they can pass on to you are going to be very, very different.
Kishore Mahumani was on the podcast with me and he grew up also. His family was very poor and he was talking about if it wasn't for his friends and it wasn't for the schools and it wasn't for the library, he never would have escaped and had that social mobility.
Right, that's the tricky thing, right? So in Singapore, we think of upward social mobility. And I think what that suggests is that a working class background is something that you need to escape from. The working class in Singapore, I mean, there is definitely a certain identity. It's been something that over the years is kind of difficult to locate, right? Because, for example, in some of the countries, working class identity is tied in with, say, trade union activities, certain kinds of grassroots activities, for example. So I think that kind of aspiration also needs to be unpacked, you know, because we assume that it is a good, that somehow or the other, oh, your sons, your children are doing sort of better than you economically, let's say, in terms of social capital and all that. But I think implicit in that is this idea that, oh, it's not good to be a member of the working class. And I think that's not an idea that I would like to perpetuate.
I hear you, but I think that you're going to have a very, very difficult time getting parents not to want improvement for their kids.
Sure, of course,
and right now that means
their children having sort of like being better educated and all that. Yeah, I mean, I see that as part of this whole Singapore story of wanting to improve, wanting to sort of graduate, so to speak, on the social ladder to a different class. But I think one should still be able to identify with your own class background, even though, you know, material conditions have changed.
Did your parents push you?
Wow. I think what's interesting is that when I was very young, my mom insisted that I make friends with non-Malay kids. And I think it was a form of a domestic kind of social engineering. Mm-hmm. But when I was young, I felt there was a certain kind of racial ideology that was at work, in the sense that I assumed that it was because she would think that me hanging out with Malay kids would mean that I would adopt, you know, certain kinds of like cultural deficits, right? So this idea of certain races being tied to certain kind of stereotypes, like, okay, Malay kids are going to be lazy, they're not going to be academically inclined, they're not going to be smart, for example. And then much later, I realized that it was her way of kind of like coercing me to speak more English.
And do you think it's changed? Do you think that Malay parents now are doing the same thing?
What's been really interesting, so I've seen a few statistics, right? So for very long, Malay was the home language of a lot of members of the Malay community. But I think over the past maybe 20 years, that has really changed in the sense that English is now the dominant language at home. And I think that's a good thing in terms of the education system, because once you have English, that's the kind of social capital in school, because the medium of instruction is in English. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, your language proficiency would not be be a handicap for you in learning all the subjects.
And what about Singlish?
Singlish for me is a very interesting kind of decolonial gesture. Yeah, I think it's a way to seize English from the colonizers and make it our own and insist on a plurality of Englishes, right? Mm-hmm.
I get that. And I would say 75% of the time I can understand it.
Yeah.
But when people can only use it versus being able to turn it off and speak proper English,
right,
it's actually a detriment because they can't talk to people outside of Singapore.
The Singlish debate, right?
Right.
And apparently, like, there was a crackdown at one point of time. So we have the TV show, Pochukang, for example. Mm-hmm. And suddenly he's made to speak so-called proper English, right? So this idea that because he's speaking Singlish, it's going to set a bad example. I do believe that in many, many languages, we have both a formal as well as colloquial version.
Right.
And I think instead of just trying to, like, eradicate Singlish completely, I think what we should be able to acknowledge is that there is a vernacular version of English that is spoken. Yeah, we should be aware that, okay, there's Singlish, but then there are formal varieties of English as well. And we should, being in a multicultural society, be able to code switch among all those.
Yeah. How would you describe yourself as a writer, Alfian?
A lot of my works deal with, say, you know, the socio-political. So my role, and not to be prescriptive about it, is to kind of provide a space for the minority view. And that's because I think certain views are very, very dominant in society to the point where they become certain forms of myth-making. And I think once in a while, it's really important to kind of question those norms, to question status quo, and to really kind of like analyze how we've come to form those opinions, for example, right? Is it because we are dead certain about those particular opinions, or is it because of the absence of alternatives which have somehow been censored, which have been suppressed, right? So if we have like a media which is pretty much state-controlled or pretty much takes the government line most of the time, you can see that that's a space where it's very difficult to find the dissenting views.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how did you go from writer to poet to playwright and then ultimately resident playwright for Wild Rice?
Wow. I started with, I pitched a play to Ivan Heng in the year 2004, and it was called Asian Boys Volume 2. And with that play, I received my first Best Original Script Award at the Theatres Live Theatre Awards.
Your first of how many?
Not to flex, but there's been four.
Okay, no flex
so
when
far,
I ask
no
you.
Flex. And yeah, and I think Ivan was impressed enough with that. I think he recognized that, you know, I had a certain kind of voice and certain point of view that he wanted to encourage in a playwright. And he felt that my kind of, let's say, political orientation, my views were in alignment with Wild Rice.
As a writer, as a playwright, as a poet, what is the biggest challenge artistically?
I think one of the challenges in making theatre in Singapore is trying to overcome, let's say, state paranoia about art making in Singapore, right? So this idea that artists are out to subvert or destabilize society, that the artists are always up to some kind of mischief. And this kind of like resentment that we should have a platform in which to espouse our views. And that platform is not necessarily something that is they've been able to completely control, for example. Yeah. So that's why you have something like the licensing scheme for plays. So every time you need to stage a play in Singapore, we have to submit a script to the Infocom Media Development Authority of Singapore. And you have to submit a script like 2 months in advance. And then they look at it and they give it a rating, for example. One can say, oh, so at least they don't ban it. But I think that's not the right way to look at it. Because obviously in other societies, you don't even have to submit a script before you put on a play. So there's general and then there's advisory. There's advisory 16. And then there's restricted 18, for example. You know, one can say, oh, they're just ratings. It's just consumer advice. But there are material kind of like implications to these things. So if you have an R18 for a play, it's not likely that schools will have school bookings for your play.
Speaking of schools,
yes.
My daughter, B, is at Nanyang Girls High. And yeah. She's told me on more than one occasion that she's read your poems as a part of the curriculum.
Yeah.
And I wonder what you hope the students will take away from your work.
I don't think I write poems or plays with like messages inside them, right? So I'm very careful about using art to proselytize. I think you can do it much better in like an essay, you know, if you write an op-ed, even in a podcast, yeah. So I believe in the integrity and the autonomy of the artwork as a work of art in itself. I think at the very least, I'm invested in the idea that as a piece of literature, students learn critical thinking skills, learn how to analyze, learn how to interpret. Because this is going to be a very, very important skill these days when we are sometimes flooded with so much misinformation. And I think that kind of like media literacy, which I think is an extension of a kind of literary activity, is important. How you're able to assess, let's say, the truth value of a work. How do you assess what a writer is trying to convey? I think those things are very, very important.
But do you worry about young people now? Because it's not just young people. Everybody is in a silo of sorts. And we only receive the information that we like.
Right. Yeah.
And we're living in our own little bubble.
That's an interesting question. As you mentioned, the silos or the echo chambers, right? Yeah. Are we only receiving information which reflects our own views and biases? And how do we then get out of those? And I think for me, one of the avenues is really to expose yourself to watching plays, reading books, because I think that's when you're able to access views that might be quite different from your own. And and I think only when you have views that challenge the ones that you hold dearly, the ones that you think are quite fixed, then you know there's a certain kind of maturity that comes with it.
And I think there's also a maturity that when you have a fixed idea, but then you are exposed to something that questions it, and you think, maybe I need to reshape this known in my mind.
Absolutely. So I think as writers, we are very careful about people who claim to have absolute certainties about certain things, right? So I think the work of literature is really about pointing out to all these gray areas, to all these moral ambiguities, to all these social complexities that cannot be articulated in the form of a pithy kind of like hot take or slogan.
When Jim and I were going around the world, I was 29 when we set off. I was very naive to see the different forms of journalism around the world,
right,
to read the American press account of what happened when America bombed the embassy in Yugoslavia. They hit the Chinese embassy. Right. I was in Beijing when that happened. I'm reading the Chinese press.
Yeah.
I'm getting the American press, and they're entirely different stories.
Right.
And one of the things that I do now is I do try to read the news broadly. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe right-wing, but also left-wing.
Yes.
Because my parents live in a right-wing silo.
Right.
That's all they know, and they know it's the only way. But I know it's not. You have to be broad in how you get the news, how you get views on many things.
Yeah, I think that's been a lifelong project for me. So especially in Singapore, right? When you know that there's not enough of a plurality of voices in the mainstream media, I think there's a certain kind of obligation to find out like whose voices are not being represented and what particular points of view are not being aired.
Well, I feel, as I said before, that you are the contrarian. And I think that very, very often that you're demonized for your negative sentiments, and people don't look at your works broadly because I have watched your pantomimes that you've written, Monkey Goes West, Mama White Snake, both of which my daughters performed with Wild Rice in the pantomimes.
Yeah.
And these are feel-good family moments where people leave the theater uplifted on life. They're in the holiday spirit. They feel great about Singapore. They feel great about Singlish. Yet nobody ever kind of gives you credit for that part of your work. Mm-hmm. And do you feel like you're judged too harshly?
Interesting question, because, you know, I don't like to assume the position of a victim, to be honest. I think if one really takes a sober look at what you mentioned, the breadth of my work, I think that there's a lot of stuff there, and you can see that there's a lot of care that's being taken to express certain things, and they are really quite nuanced and in many ways try to incorporate as many points of view as possible. So I don't think they are strident and polemical kind of works, which is very different from, say, social media, for example, right? And in social media, for example, I might, like, let's say, feel very outraged by a certain news story, and therefore I express quite stridently, you know, my view about it at that particular time. And it's very possible, for example, to take those things in isolation, put them all together, and make me look like, oh my God, this person is like perpetually angry. But actually, these posts are written like maybe weeks apart. And in between, there are all other kinds of posts as well that have been conveniently excluded from that kind of a curation. So I do feel the people who do it definitely have a certain kind of agenda. It is not the kind of editorial work that I definitely endorse or approve of. I feel that it's almost tantamount to some kind of character assassination. The thing is that as a writer in Singapore, I realize that that's the kind of territory that comes with it. And I think it's important to sort of broad perspective about it, to know fundamentally that for me, dissent is democracy.
I wonder, because of the dissent, have you ever worried for your own safety?
Wow. In the early years, of course, because of all these stories that I think I have inherited as someone who is a member of theatre community, as someone who knows theatre history in Singapore. So I'm looking at, say, the arrest of, for me, one of the greatest pioneers of Singapore theatre in Singapore, Mr. Koh Pao Kun, arrested under the Internal Security Act in the 1970s, I think it was around 4 years. And then there was the third stage in 1987, around four members of them, I think, were arrested under the Internal Security Act again in 1987 and accused of being part of this very strange and dubious thing called the Marxist conspiracy. So I think that is the kind of inheritance that has shadowed what it means to make theatre in Singapore. I grew up wondering, oh my gosh, you know, that there is this law called the ISA in Singapore, and it's detention without trial, right? So they can accuse you of something, and it's impossible for you to sort of try to defend yourself in court, because that kind of due process is not available to you.
Well, you've been labeled a pro-Malaysia activist by the PAP.
Yes.
But Tommy Koh, who's been on my podcast, Professor Tommy Koh, defended you and said you're a loving critic of Singapore. Mm. Why do you continue to keep at it?
So first of all, I really have to thank, you know, someone like Tommy Koh, who has come in with a certain kind of moral authority, right? And who has stood up for me. At the same time also, I do think being called a loving critic is kind of quite problematic, because it's almost as if it's something that I have to live up to, right? I have to sort of demonstrate that I love this country somehow. But I want to say that it's possible to have a space where you're just a critic. Mm. Why do you necessarily have to be a loving critic? Why do you need that kind of qualifier? And why critics exist in this society? Why do they have to be tarred and feathered or demonized, for example, right? Because why do we see critics as essentially destructive forces? Why can't we see that, you know, they have a role to play in any society?
And so how does Singapore get there? How does Singapore get to the point that we can have a dissenter, we can have someone speak out against accepted policy and not be seen as a turncoat?
The ball is in the government's court, actually. To come down so hard on people who criticize you is not a mark of strength. It's much more a mark of strength to think, oh, actually, these criticisms, yes, maybe there's some validity, we'll take them on board, you know, but if you are completely convinced in the system and the way and your approach, whatever, then defend your approach rather than attack your critics. For me, one of the ways in which we can have that is more political plurality. I think they've been able to get away with that kind of standard of debate because there's just not enough opposition in parliament.
Are there any politicians who you think are doing a good job?
I think the Workers' Party has been very steadfast. Yeah, and I like people like Sylvia Lim, for example. Yeah, and Pritam Singh.
And why are they doing it better?
Because I think given the kinds of attacks that they've been subjected to, I think they've been able to hold their ground and they've been able to do it with dignity and conviction. Mm-hmm. Yeah, where one can see that I think like lesser people would have actually quite caved in to the kind of very asymmetrical kind of power relation that exists in the parliament right now. Because it's not easy to be that little minority in parliament under incessant attack on all sides. But I think they've been really, really able to hold their own and they deserve so much credit for that.
Engage with Paige. For the past 8 years, I've been on the board for United Women Singapore because I believe women hold up half the sky. At UWS, we work to narrow the gender inequality gap. At a recent STEMFest event, I led a panel of three young women. They're all involved in our STEM program. They're smart, articulate, and ready to stand shoulder to shoulder with any man and probably surpass him. Let's stop talking about gender inequality and walk the talk. Shall we call out sexism even when it's uncomfortable? When I was researching for our podcast, I kept coming across the poem you wrote when you were 21.
Yes.
I'm sure you're asked about it every single time.
Yes.
And Singapore, you are not my country.
Yep.
I've seen all of the interviews, well, many of them. It seems to me that you always point to the parts of the poem that illustrate your love of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, just now, you told me you didn't want to be a loving critic.
Yeah.
So two questions.
Yes.
Do you feel that you need to defend yourself by saying, yes, I said these things, but there's also an adoration in the poem?
Yeah.
The second question is, do you have regret over this poem?
Wow. Okay. So I think maybe for me, I felt that I was on this firing range, right? You know, the attacks were coming quite fast and furious because I think it was easy for the state to kind of mobilize some of their supporters to attack me based on this particular poem, to sort of like extract just a few lines and sometimes to quote them, like not even like the whole line itself, which I thought was a little bit mischievous.
Journalists do that every day, everywhere in the world.
They do, yeah. But that goes against the whole ethos of reading literature, right? So I thought that there was something quite sinister about that whole act. Because it's one thing to select or edit what one has said in an interview, but if you have a poem that's been written with a lot of care, and then you decide to sort of like abridge it and sort of just pick out the parts that serve your own agenda, I think that's something very deeply problematic. But that said, so I think the first instinct was to say, hey, you know, actually, this poem is not what you think it is. It is. It's not some kind of like traitorous screed, anti-Singapore kind of screed. I think it is a person who's trying to work through a love-hate relationship with the country. So there are moments of like frustration and disappointment and grief and anguish and all that. But there are moments also when I'm talking about, you know, my childhood in Singapore and the things that I feel are really part of me because I've grown up here, right? So Singapore is in so many ways in my blood and marked on my body, and there are certain stirrings which are very involuntary for me, like when Anthem is played, for example. So I think that was my first instinct. But then, like, when I sit down and really think about it, I felt like, wait, why do I have to try to, like, justify to others how much I love this country? Is that a kind of obligation that you have as a citizen to sort of be able to, like, proclaim how much you love this country? Is every Singaporean subject to that kind of scrutiny, you know? So I think, again, this kind of labeling is just very, very unhelpful.
Any regret over that poem?
No regrets at all. That poem is a document of my feelings and my thought processes as a 21-year-old who was working through my own sense of, like, belonging and identity about being in Singapore.
At age 21, mm-hmm. I think most of us are at our most extreme, our most liberal, because that's when we're really starting to open and question.
Right.
And I think that if we don't have the most extreme kind of ideas at mm-hmm. that age, as we get older, I think we're going to become more and more conservative. Mm. So I think the youth mm. and the allowing us to think and speak and having that love-hate relationship right. and putting it on paper. And mm. then, and how old are you now?
45.
Okay, but I'm, yeah. in all the interviews, it's still there. This poem that you wrote at age 21 is still used to yes. define you.
Yeah.
Which countries in the world are doing it better than Singapore? I have lived here now for 15 years, yes. and so many people complain about Singapore.
Yeah.
I've lived elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
and I know that this place is not utopia,
yep.
but it also works pretty darn well.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So where do you think works better?
That's a very complex question. There's no perfect system in the world. And I think sometimes we criticize because we think that there's room for improvement. Mm-hmm. We think that there are things that can actually be done better, you know, and we are proposing certain alternatives to be considered. And I think that there's so many countries, even those that are around us, where, you know, it's the norm or it's kind of like a kind of orthodoxy in Singapore to actually put them down and say that, oh, actually, you know, coming from Singapore, we are exceptional, or, you know, we have a system that's superior, look at our exchange rate, etc. You know, everyone wants to come to Singapore and work here. But of course, all those other countries also have got their own virtues as well. And I think what's more important for me is that if those are democratic countries, then at least we should respect popular sovereignty, right? At least we should respect the fact that, well, the citizens, you know, chose this particular system. But at the same time, also, we should also appreciate or acknowledge the kinds of constraints that they work under as well. Yeah, I think every country, good and bad, it's not easy to say, oh, I think like the Scandinavian social democratic system is good, you know, because I think those systems have evolved under very specific conditions.
Mm-hmm. In New York, if the subway does not break down yeah. once a day, that makes the news.
Right.
And here, when it breaks down, yeah. people get really, really agitated. And part yeah. of that is yeah. the government's doing yeah. a good job on things.
I think part of the reason why people get kind of frustrated if things break down, as you mentioned, is precisely because this has been the social contract in Singapore. In the sense that I feel that we have a government that is running on what is known as performance legitimacy, mm. right? In which Singaporeans have allowed or consented to the taking away of a lot of rights and civil liberties in exchange for what they expect to be peak performance. So peak delivery of like goods and services, yeah, peak economic performance and all that, yeah. So in a sense, you can say the government is a victim of its own success, mm-hmm. right? So because they promised that, okay, trust us, we know what's best for you. And I think because of that, then there is a certain kind of perfectionism that is kind of expected of them.
Yeah. Can it be sustained?
Yeah. I don't know. I think the way out of this bind is to actually say, okay, you know what? We are not infallible. We are going to make mistakes. And therefore, don't expect this very technocratic government to have all the solutions. But then at the same time, there should be a kind of liberalization that goes along with that. So I think Singaporeans would be a lot more forgiving of all these sort of like inefficiencies if they are a bit more enfranchised.
Tell me why you continue to write and discuss topics mm-hmm. that many people want to shove under the rug. I'm thinking about yeah. Cook a Pot of Curry, mm-hmm. Cooling Off Day, yeah. your most recent play, the death of Singapore Theatre, which was sold out and I couldn't get tickets.
Right, yeah.
You keep at it. Mm-hmm. Is it your job now? You are the descent, and is your role?
I don't know. I think for me, the simple answer is I don't know how else to write. In a sense that the things that excite me, the things that inspire me, the things that for me feel urgent or vital are precisely these things. And of course, you know, as you mentioned, there is a danger to it, but all other topics don't really interest me at the end of the day.
And so, do you think social media has worked against the government?
I don't know. I mean, I see like the government recognizing that it's an important kind of force. And I do see the government themselves kind of like either co-opting social media or jumping on the bandwagon. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's a territory that is necessarily adversarial or hostile to the government all the time. I mean, there are some pockets of autonomy, you know, but I think, yeah, it's not necessarily an anti-establishment space.
But if you go on TikTok, there's a lot of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
There is, you know, yeah. but I think I'm pretty sure the government has an arm somewhere which tries to kind of like, yeah, be part of those conversations as well, try to infiltrate and establish a presence.
So we've heard you talking about the need to dissent. Mm-hmm. I imagine because of that, that's been kind of your toughest struggle because mm-hmm. there are not many here. Yeah. How do you handle this? And mm-hmm. how do you dissent but still remain a respectable artist people want to engage and have on their team?
So I think it's important that to know at the end of the day that I'm not doing this alone. There is a community out there that I'm not just speaking from the depths of my basement or attic, you know, that I'm not speaking from a position of like profound isolation and alienation from society, that there are certain things that I say that does resonate with a public out there, that there's an audience that feels, you know, I identify with this point of view, and I feel that, this reflects something that I've been trying to say, but I haven't been able to articulate.
Do you think it's the duty of art to be provocative?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Should it be a call to action?
I'm not sure about call to action, because I think that's the realm of activism.
Okay.
Yeah. Not to say that I don't think art doesn't have a role to play in activism. I think it does. In the way that it can, as I mentioned earlier, you know, challenge certain preconceptions, certain firmly held beliefs, in the way it can challenge certain myths that we hold dear, that how it can slaughter certain sacred cows even, because I think this is the way for us to mature, the way for us to be able to accept and not just tolerate differences in society.
Alfian, do you consider yourself successful?
Wow, I think that would hinge on how I would define success.
Well, tell us, how do you define success?
it's a really tough question. There's a dominant kind of a view of what is success in Singapore, I suppose. At one point in time, it was the five C's, right? Cash, condo, credit card, country club. Something like that, right? So that's one measure of success. And it was obviously a kind of like material success. And of course, there's a kind of success that you can peg to, let's say, winning awards, for example, right?
And you've won many.
Getting some kind of critical acclaim, yeah.
Yes.
But again, it's important to kind of also question the kind of accreditation. Question like, oh, why did I win it actually? Who were the judges in that year? Who are the other sort of like contenders? It is an award that's been given by a news organization.
Wow, you're even questioning when you get an award.
No, obviously, of course.
I love it.
You have to. I think that's very, very important to not sort of like just rest in your laurels and assume automatically that
it's valid.
That is valid, yeah, exactly. You know, I always have to question like, oh, did I get it? Because in a particular year, you know, there's a newsy angle to me getting this award. Did I get it also because, let's say, for many years, it was like Chinese people who've been winning this and they wanted to maybe give it to Malay theatre.
Diversify.
You know? Diversify, yeah, exactly. You know, so I think it's just important to always question these things.
What are the three traits of someone you deem successful? The listeners out there, they want a tangible takeaway from this podcast.
Yeah,
what are the three things that I can do and I will be successful according to you?
I think it's more important to be happy than to be successful.
But maybe your success is happy. It's happiness. I mean,
the problem is that I feel that success often comes from like external validation. On one hand, it's important to get the kind of like acclaim from your peers, for example, or your community or your society. But at the same time also, I do feel, you know, happiness is something that comes from within, is something that only you get to decide for yourself. And I know that there are a lot of people who, by very conventional measures of what is success, will not be seen as successful, but more importantly, they're happy at doing what they're doing, right? So on this subject of happiness, I think it's important to see that happiness is not just about pleasure, right? Mm-hmm. It is about purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Having a sense of purpose is so important to my own definitions of happiness and also mental health,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things you said before about the external validation, it's something that whenever I get the opportunity to talk to young people, I always say, figure out what is your why? What mm-hmm. makes you happy?
Right,
because it might not be the next promotion. It might be leaving work at 6 so you can go home and be with your family.
Oh, yeah,
and there's
absolutely.
Nothing wrong with that.
Exactly.
If that's what makes you satisfied.
That's right, yeah.
So I think that we do get caught up in the external validation of what it is to be a success. And I would just challenge everyone to figure out what it is that is your success and to try to run after that and not what everybody else is telling you
absolutely
success is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you won't be happy that way. I just turned 54, so I'm a decade older than you are. And I spent a lot of time being a pleaser, being, constantly wanting to make everybody around me happy.
Right, right, yes.
And I would say in the last 5 years, I stopped being that way and I'm much, much, much happier. Part of it is being a female growing up in the South and just the way we're reared to take care of everybody. And of course I want to take care of people.
Of course, yeah.
But you can't do that and short yourself in the process. And so, it took me a long time to get there.
Mm-hmm,
but once you figure out the things that are important to you and you work to attain those, that's your success.
Yep.
Now I'm turning into like my podcast. They're interviewing me. But I feel so strongly about the fact that we do have to really strive for what's important to us and let that be our success. So that really resonated with me.
Right.
Which of your works are you most proud of?
The most recent work that I've done. Right. So I think one of my recent works is this thing called The Death of Singapore Theatre as scripted by the Infocom Media Development Authority of Singapore. Yeah. What I feel is a culmination of all these kind of frustration I've been feeling about the way we have had to make theatre in this country. But in this particular play, I chose a different mode, which is a meta theatrical mode, where I'm thinking, okay, you know, I don't want to speak in a coded way anymore. I don't want to speak in a kind of like a slant language, indirectly, whatever. I just want to confront this thing head on. So I wrote the play as a form of direct address to whichever censor is supposed to vet the script. So inside the play, you know, it has these lines like, you, I know it's you, who else could it be but you? Where are you reading the script? Are you reading on your laptop? Did you print it out? Do you have a pencil in your hand to like cross or circle, you know, offending lines, etc. So it was really a provocation. Mm. It was really, I think, to put a spotlight on the censor, because I believe that we have to create our own archive of censorship, because if we don't do that, then we are going to be complicit in the censorship of the archive.
What is the censor officially called in Singapore? What is the person who reads the play called? I don't want to be on a mothership because we're calling them the censor.
Right. I mean, they probably hate to be called censors,
of course.
Right? The same way.
And you just said it 6 times.
Yes. Yeah. Because I feel like calling a spade a spade. So I think they call it something like a standards manager or something like that. Yeah.
So what was it rated, the play?
I got an advisory 16.
Which theater group put it on?
So this was produced by the Substation.
Substation.
Yeah.
Do you have a piece of advice for aspiring authors, playwrights?
Yeah, of course. I just want to say, write whatever the hell you want, you know? Because the minute you start to think of all these other kind of forces, then it's no longer your own writing.
Mm-hmm.
You are co-writing it with this particular censor that you've imported into your head. There is someone else that is placing their hand on you as you're writing your script or your poem or whatever. And it's so important to expunge, you know, that person, yeah.
And what if they write process. It and then nobody will have anything to do with it because it's too extreme?
Then I think cross the bridge when you get there. But never ever kind of like preempt these kinds of responses. And in fact, if you actually go as far as you can go with your script and then it lands on the censor's desk, that is something that will challenge them. That is something that will make them aware, oh my gosh, you know, young people are thinking these things and writing these things, and we have to deal with this, right? And then hopefully it might sort of like nudge them into thinking, oh my God, if they're getting all these scripts that are going to be rated R18, for example, then it will kind of show up a certain kind of defect in their censorship infrastructure.
And one of the things that I've heard said with your name in reference is, if he doesn't like it here,
yeah,
then why doesn't he go somewhere else? And to those people, what do you say?
Well, it's because I really want to see change happening here. I think for me to go somewhere else is a form of
surrender.
Kind of surrender, absolutely, yeah. Right? It's a sense of like, oh, I've given up on this place. It's because I still care mm-hmm. about Singapore. My God, I'm going into the whole loving critic mode. Right? which in the beginning there, I said I wasn't going to go down the path of. But yeah, I still feel like I do give a damn about Singapore to accept the kinds of risks that come with the territory of speaking up. Because I do feel that it's important for these conversations to continue. And I do want to be a part of this process of change in Singapore.
And that's why I asked you to be on the podcast.
Yeah.
I agree. And what do you say to the listeners who are just following the status quo?
I don't think I'm necessarily in a position to say, oh, you know, you are brainwashed, for example, you know, or you're not reading widely or whatever. But I think it's also important to know that if there are people who think differently, so even the term contrarian, I find is something that I might want to take issue with because it's not opposing for the sake of opposing. Yeah, because I feel that that's kind of a mischaracterization of the work that a lot of us do. A lot of us question because we feel that there's so much potential in this country and that it shouldn't be wasted on only, you know, very, very narrow ways of thinking, whether it's groupthink or whether it's a certain attachment to certain orthodoxies that might have worked for us in the past. But, you know, we live in an era where it's globalization, there's so many changes happening, and I think we need to be able to adapt to those changes. And I think that's when it's important to listen to the dissenters.
So dissenter versus contrarian.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. We got it.
Yes.
What's something few know about you?
Oh gosh.
I play Candy Crush.
Right. I actually really like watching cat videos, and that's my...
Cat
videos, yeah. That's my decompression, right? I can watch like 15 minutes of like just random cat videos.
Do you have a cat?
I do. I really love watching cat videos. I think they're the best thing that's happened on the internet.
Wow. I like you, Alfian, but I don't like cats. Do you have a question for me?
Yeah, so are you more like a dog person?
I love dogs, I'm definitely a dog person. I have a dog, Bella.
Right.
And she has an Instagram account. It's called I Am Bella Sage. Her name is Bella Sage Parker Rogers.
Right.
And she's a miniature Labradoodle. She's the sweetest thing in the wide world. She's my shadow.
Wow. So, yeah. Okay.
Is that your question?
That was my question.
Wow, that got off light. Right. I was waiting for something heavy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, here we are at the end. So I guess the close would be your best advice to pass the power on to our listeners.
It's easy in Singapore to sometimes feel a little hopeless when it comes to change because we feel that we are powerless, or we feel that the odds are so stacked against us, you know, that maybe we've been so disenfranchised. What kinds of power do we have as the ordinary citizen, for example? But actually, we do have that power, and that power comes with solidarity. That power comes with community. If you feel strongly about an issue, it's important to know that you're not alone, that, you know, that there are people out there who are turning knowledge into action all the time. There are a lot of young people, especially, and I think this is very important. I think for a very long time, had a tendency to dismiss young people. And also something that you've mentioned just now, you know, like we mentioned, like, oh, something that I wrote when I was 21, it was because, you know, I had quite sort of like strong kind of opinions that was untempered by realities or, you know, the pragmatic demands of real life. But actually, it's because young people have this that I think they're able to imagine all these possibilities, you know, that their horizons are actually a lot broader because they can see the future, and that future is something that they are going to live with. So they're very invested in, for example, climate change. I'm so heartened to see young people at the forefront of climate activism, right, in Singapore, invested in migrant worker issues and in LGBT issues, for example. And I think they should be really taken seriously, you know, and we shouldn't kind of like dismiss them as, oh, this is like, yeah, young people acting up or young people trying to find their place in the world. They've already found their purpose and their place in the world. Yeah. And we need to see them at eye level and we need to listen to them.
Thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
That wraps another fascinating conversation to offer food for thought and a different perspective, and hopefully inspire you to live life fully with passion. Hopefully you appreciate the tangible takeaways and meaningful stories. Please message me on Instagram at @IamPageParker and let me know how we can do this better. As always, thank you for listening, as together we pass the power.